Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Detroit. He was an All-American basketball player from Murray Wright High School. In 1986, at age 16, a bullet from a .357 Magnum severed his spinal cord and made him a paraplegic, ending his NBA hoop dreams. Today, he's the president of Pioneers for Peace, a group that takes violence prevention programs on the road, into classrooms, and into our communities. His name? Wayusi Olosola, and we're honored to have him as our guest. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760, WJR.
Now back to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Wayusi Olosola. Why? Welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. Pleased to be here.
Can you start by telling us about your childhood and your parents?
Certainly, yes. I had a pretty, pretty normal childhood, I guess, from my particular standpoint of my peers being a child growing up in the urban area of Detroit. I guess you could say we were a very poor but proud family. I was, unlike many of my peers at the time, for up until I was like eight, both my parents were married, so I grew up in a two-parent household. I'm the youngest of three siblings. For the most part, I grew up looking up to my bigger brother, trying to follow his footsteps, and kind of, I guess you could say I was a mama's boy. I kind of leaned more towards following my mom and learned a lot. Kind of under her tutelage. My dad worked a lot. He worked for one of the subsidiaries of the automakers who makes the parts for them. And he worked a lot. He was a pretty good dad, though. Kind of wasn't quite the disciplinarian that I would have liked for him to, or probably needed for him to be. But my mom was strong enough to take care of all of that. So I grew up pretty much actually around the city. A lot of times we tend to either be east or west side here in Detroit, and actually I grew up in my childhood east side for a number of years, west side for the most part, as well as southwest Detroit as well.
What did you learn from your parents? The values?
Hard work, and anything worth having you got to work hard for, and nothing comes easy that's gonna last long. And those were pretty much, I guess you could say, some of the more profound things that I picked up. Also, I would guess from my mother, because also I must say, I was kind of prepared in sort of a way for what would happen to me later in life. That is, my mother was a person with a disability, actually. She suffered from a rare hip disease, actually, where she sustained many hip replacements throughout her lifetime, and she had difficulty walking and was in a lot of pain. And there were times in her life where she did use a wheelchair and use an aid to walk as well. So having to grow up helping my mom out at times and kind of seeing her endure some of the hardships that came along with the various adversity that, you know, living physically challenged brings to an individual, kind of prepared me, so to speak, for what I would be facing later in my life.
You're 16 years old. You're an All-American basketball player. You got a great future, Murray Wright High School, and your life changes in an instant. Can you share that with us?
Yes. Wow. Going back to that unforgettable summer of 1986, when this occurred, as you stated, I was an All-American basketball player. I must also say this part that never gets mentioned often, but I also was and the marching band, concert band, and the jazz band as well. So I kind of had two avenues I was kind of pursuing scholarship with, but my passion was basketball, and it was kind of my time, so to speak. In PSL, there's various pockets where there's a lot of talent and there's a little talent, and fortunately for me at that particular time, there wasn't a lot of talent coming out, so I was one of the few prospects being highly recruited. So I guess you could say I was on top of the world at that time in my life, if one could say. Everything was seemingly going my way. So, truly, when this occurred, it was very devastating, not just to me, but also to my family, who also kind of were my rooting squad, who saw a lot of potential that I had, and was really crushed because of their own high expectations and wanting me to succeed. I would have been the first individual at that time to actually go to college in my family. So everyone was kind of rooting for me. So it was really a hard thing when this occurred.
What actually happened?
Well, on this particular evening, I was also working a part-time job at a restaurant, actually Hardee's restaurant to be exact, downtown. And I got off work and came home and changed out of my uniform and went back up the street and stopped in front of a friend's house and chatted for a little bit with her. And within about 15, 20 minutes, all of a sudden we heard gunfire just erupting from seemingly out of nowhere. When it all boiled down, I was struck four times, twice in the chest, twice in the stomach. One of the bullets went in my abdomen and went straight through me, and that was the bullet that actually severed my spinal cord. So as a result of that, it rendered me paralyzed from the waist down, which is also termed as being a paraplegic. I'm also sad to say I wasn't the only youngster that was injured that evening. Inside the house, there was a party for smaller kids. An 8-year-old girl was killed by the gunfire. A 6-year-old girl was wounded in the face and in her arm, and the young lady I was talking to outside, who was 15, was wounded once in the leg.
We're talking to Wayusi Olosola, who turned this tragedy into triumph. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Wayusi Olosola. Wayusi, in an instant, the rest of your life changes forever. What happened? How long were you in the hospital?
Well, as it panned out, I sustained some pretty significant injuries. The gun that I was actually used in the shooting was a .357 Magnum, which was a pretty powerful weapon. So being struck twice in the chest, twice in the abdomen, I sustained some pretty gripping injuries. Actually, probably was in intensive care for about 2 weeks. I sustained considerable damage to my liver. My lungs collapsed. Ironically, I had open heart surgery, and right where my heart is beating at, I was shot directly there. And I don't mention this aspect often, actually, when I share my story publicly, but they referred to me as the miracle child while in the hospital because, as I said, right where my heart is beating at, I was struck right there. So when they opened me up to see what type of damages had, had occurred there, to their astonishment, none had occurred. My heart had kind of shifted, as they said, and missed the impact of the bullet. So they had never seen anything like that occur in a particular incident like that. So they referred to me as their miracle child, which was quite interesting. But I was in intensive care for probably about two months, a little over, and then I probably stayed another 3 weeks in the hospital before I was eventually transferred to the Rehabilitation Institute of Michigan.
Did you ever find out who did it?
Yes, we did, actually. And all of this, of course, I'm sharing out of hindsight, and it was out of hindsight even when I found out, because at the particular time all this transpired, none of us had any idea what was going on. Particularly what happened was at that particular time in the 80s, and particularly, you know, it's when we had the explosion of crack cocaine in the inner cities. And many people were riffing over various territories and so forth. So this particular incident actually was a result of one drug dealer shooting up another drug dealer's home, and the other one retaliated, sent a hit squad, if you will. There were six shooters that was involved in this particular incident. They came later that evening and shot up the house, and just so happened to be the wrong house, though, I must say. It was a house I was standing in front of. The house they actually wanted was three houses down from the house where the shooting took place.
Were you bitter?
Oh, absolutely. I was extremely bitter, very bitter. I was crushed. I was mad at the world. I felt life had cheated me. I say that because I was particularly a pretty good kid. I had my particular bouts maybe a year and a half before that occurred, where I, you know, kind of connected with the wrong crowd and strayed away from the path, so to speak, as most of us do. But I had an incident where my best friend was killed, and that was a really eye-opening wake-up call for me to not take my life for granted and really, you know, try to make the most out of, you know, what I had, you know, my abilities in terms of music and athletics. So the bitterness, you know, for me was really, you know, it's just interesting how, you know, and we often say now, you never know what tomorrow may bring. And instantaneously, my life changed, you know, within a split second. So as being 16 years of age and not really understanding quite the significance that a spinal cord injury has and how it impacts one's life forever, I was a bit clueless, really, up until being admitted to the Rehab Institute was really, really when I would say the reality was really brought more to light in terms of me understanding the permanency of the situation, and that this was an irreversible thing, that there was no surgery, or I don't know how much, no matter how much therapy I underwent, I was never going to walk again. And the doctors were pretty frank with me with that. And I questioned their bedside manner years ago, but I guess there's really no easy way you can present this type of news to an individual, and especially here you are, you know, speaking of a young kid, basketball star, a lot of, you know, colleges interested in me, a lot of hopes and aspirations, you know, for myself and my family. So I was very frustrated, angry, and really didn't see a future for myself, I would say.
How did you overcome? You have no bitterness. How did you overcome all this hatred and bitterness?
Wow. Well, believe me, it wasn't overnight, and it definitely wasn't easy. I guess there were a few factors that played a role in it. I guess one of the things that happened for me pretty early was while still an inpatient at the Rehab Institute, I received a visit from then Detroit Pistons star Isaiah Thomas. And at this particular time, we were experiencing a rash of violence in the city, particularly with the young people. I recall they referred to that summer as the Blood Summer. And many community members and agencies and organizations were trying to rally, you know, to just raise the awareness about the seriousness and what was going on at the time. So he was actually sponsoring a No Crime Day parade, and he came to the hospital to visit me. He had read about my incident in the paper, which it had received quite a bit of media attention because of the kids involved and my profile as an athlete. But having him come to visit me and even invite me to be a part of the parade was really a big pickup for me. You know, he was one of the basketball players that I idled, you know, at the time. And having him just come and talk to me one-on-one, you know, really just was something special to me. And I was one of the first things that happened, I would say, to begin the process for me to begin to heal more so emotionally and spiritually. And being in the No Crime Day parade, after that parade was over with, my life began to take a new direction, you could say.
Susan St. James and her husband, Dick Ebersole, about a year ago, lost a son. And she made the statement that having bitterness is like you taking poison in the hope that the other person dies. What do you say about that?
That's a profound statement. And it really strikes a deep chord within me, because I can really feel the reality of that. And looking back over my life and the course that my life has taken, I often reflect that had I continued to be bitter and had bitterness gotten the best of me, I probably wouldn't be here today talking to you.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Wayusi Olosola, who started Pioneers for Peace. And when we come back, we'll ask him about that. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Wayusi, you started Pioneers for Peace. Can you tell us about that?
Gladly, yes. Pioneers for Peace is a violence prevention and awareness organization that's now comprised of 25 survivors of gun violence who've acquired a permanent disability as a result. 24 of our members are wheelchair users, and we have one young lady who's blind as a result from a shotgun blast to the face. Sounds tragic, I know, but truly I'm blessed, so blessed to work with such a dynamic group of survivors. And we like to use the term survivors. Ultimately, and all too often, we're looked at as victims. And survivor means that you've overcome something, you know. And truly, this is an organization that pretty much actually, I guess you could say, it didn't get started formally under that name until many years later, 96. The work that Pioneers do actually got started shortly after the No Crime Day parade I was sharing with you about. Shortly after that, my phone began to ring while still an inpatient at the Rehab Institute for me to come out and share my story with other teens. I was very reluctant initially, still having a lot of things, you know, I was processing emotionally, you know, at the time. But my mother was the one, I must say, who prevailed upon me to go out and give it a shot. And in doing that, that was probably the best thing I could have ever done. It immediately seemed like the right thing I should be doing. And it gave my life, most importantly, a great deal more purpose, you know. And that was pretty much, I guess you could say, the therapeutic tool that I was blessed to be able to have opportunity to, you know, have before me to enable me to be able to live and have my life be bigger than, you know, than just me. And that was a mission that I got started on. And we began to go out and talk to kids. And actually, back in 87, we produced a video called Wasted Dreams that profiled myself and four of the young men who were shot in similar ways, and we all shared our particular stories. And this particular documentary went on to win many many awards at film festivals, Cannes and Sundance actually, and ultimately started and launched the model for what later became Pioneers for Peace.
I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with Wayusi Olosola, who started Pioneers for Peace. and 54 bullets bind together these 25 violent survivors that make up the group. Well, you see, what do you say to a recent violent survivor who's full of hatred and bitterness?
Wow, actually, when we do encounter, one of the things I'm happy service that Pioneers for Peace provides is we do provide peer support to newly injured survivors of violence who've acquired disabilities. We encounter that quite a bit at the Rehabilitation Institute, and something that I, myself, and very few of our members had the benefit of having, actually, because there wasn't something organized at that particular time to have available to offer to people who were, you know, experiencing now altered lifestyle because of violence. And most people are very bitter, very angry. A lot of the young guys that we see come through definitely are filled with rage, hatred, and have only revenge on their minds, you know. And we're, you know, I guess one of the greatest things that first off that helps is for them to see another individual that's going through the same thing that they're going through, or for them to physically be able to see someone like, wow, okay, here, this person is in a wheelchair as well, and to see someone vibrant, happy, upbeat, you know, just from the start is I think, a reassuring feeling, because just from the meeting them, you know, automatically we notice is that their expectations for life are raised, you know. And it's kind of like we really try to just tell them that, I mean, they have to take life day to day. And the more they put their energy on revenge or what's happened to them in terms of the loss of life, you know, and the loss for the potential of life that has been lost through the injury, we try to just get them to look at some of the positives, you know, because one thing, anyone who's survived a gunshot wound definitely should feel blessed, because it always, with you know, when you're dealing with guns, it could go either way. So we always let folks, you know that, you know, from our own personal perspective, that we all feel truly blessed and feel that life, that we were extended, you know, meaning that we felt we were given a second chance. And to try to get them to just find a way to allow it to kind of bring forth something good in their life, you know.
What's the basic message you try to get across when you go into the classrooms?
Pretty point blank and simple. Our focus is our choices with youngsters, you know, choices, and also not taking your life for granted, and understanding that you need to have a plan in life. And it doesn't mean that, you know, you necessarily have to know what you want to do, you know, coming out of middle school or high school, but you just have a plan for yourself and begin to implement your plans in small steps, but mostly choices, because one of the great benefits that we bring to our presentations is a number of our members, the lifestyles that they were living during the time of their incidents is pretty much what was the reason why that occurred. You know, some of them were young, you know, involved in gangs, some were involved in selling drugs. Many of our female members were injured as a result of domestic violence. So the unhealthy lifestyle choices, you know, that our members and that we made, we were able to come there to the school to say, look at us, look at the result of what selling drugs or what gang banging or staying in an unhealthy relationship brought forth for me. And to we use that as a bridge to get them to open up to us, because youngsters oftentimes, when you come at a school assembly, you know, they look at it as they take it, they really don't take it serious, you know, and we kind of bring that seriousness and that reality to being just by our presence at the school, and we don't sugarcoat anything with our presentations. So young people, you know, I guess being able to actually see us and talk to us and see us there is more tangible, it's more real for them. and they pretty much are all a lot of the times by some of the testimonies that they hear and just how some of the day-to-day, you know, life challenges that some of our members undergo and having to have assistance. You know, we have members who are paralyzed from the neck down who need assistance around the clock just to live, you know, and they need to understand that their choices don't affect just them. And that's one of the things they're really able to see, that, you know, the people that love and care about them the most are also deeply affected by the choices that they make. And we're able to use our real life experiences to help them look at their own lives in a sort of way.
What do you do when a kid challenges you during one of these speeches?
Well, believe it or not, Jack, that's very rare. Very rarely do we have kids challenge us. And I guess that's probably based off some of the things that I just shared prior in how we present it. We have had that happen on occasion. And we kind of have a sort of a scared straight type tactic, and we're very direct, we're very boisterous, you know. We actually demand and command respect, you know. So anytime when we're delivering a presentation or a panel discussion, if we see any kids nodding or sleeping or just bad body language, bad posture, you know, we command them to sit up straight, to look at us. And there's always that one sometimes who just wants to demonstrate to the others that he's not to be messed with. And we go right out with him. We a lot of times take that individual out of the General Assembly, and a member or two will take him out in the hallway or somewhere else in a secluded area and just kick it one-on-one with that youngster. And a lot of times they're the ones that are craving and need the most attention, and a lot of times have the most issues that they're probably dealing with, you know, personally and at home.
Every priest, rabbi, minister has been asked hundreds of times, why do bad things happen to good people? How do you answer that?
Well, I look at it in an interesting way, actually, because, and I'm saying this out of hindsight also, and I try to view things and keep my perspective out of that. You know, we oftentimes what appears on the surface as bad, you know, it may not necessarily be a bad thing. And we often, a lot of times, see and say, you know, bad things always seem to happen to the best of folks, you know, and, in my particular instance, I always say, you know, this was probably one of the greatest blessings, greatest things I've ever had happen to me. And one would look at me sideways, you know, say, I don't get it, you know. But I'm looking at that because I see all of the good that has been done. And like you used the term before, triumphing over tragedy. And we share our programs in the public. We often, you know, want people to look at us as representing that within every bad or negative situation there's always a greater good that exists if you allow it to manifest. So I don't necessarily look at that statement as being concrete in terms of bad things always seem to happen to good people. It always seems that good people seem to always make good out of a bad situation, you know. And a lot of times God works in those sort of ways, because God already has ordained a greater good, and a lot of times it takes good people to be able to rise above some of those challenges and tap into it.
Wow. We're talking to Wayusi Olosola, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Crisula.
We're with Wayusi Olosola, who's 34 years old and for the last 18 years has been in a wheelchair. Wayusi, we're in a war. We live in a culture of violence and death. The movies that we watch, TV, the rap lyrics, video games, on and on and on. What can we do to turn this tide?
Well, that's an interesting question. I definitely agree with you that we definitely are in a war, which is particularly the reason why I'm dressed in fatigues today. And that's kind of the thing we like to promote in the community, is that the real war that's going on is in our own backyards and in our own cities and neighborhoods, and that's where we need to be really focusing most of our energy and our efforts. With respect to, so many of the challenges that we face with our youngsters, and how this society that we live in, is violence almost everywhere you look and turn. And ultimately, I feel we need to address it from its roots. And first and foremost, we have to be honest with ourselves and admit that we live in a culture of violence. And the only way to really reverse it, we must begin to address it from its cultural perspective. So there are many things that I feel our people can do. One of the things we always try to encourage parents to monitor their child, their child's or their children's activities, in terms of the violent video games and the violent movies and the music and the lyrics, the content of the music, that they're listening to. It's very suggestive. We've been raised, in American society, American culture is violence, violence has been all around us. I can recall as a kid, being, the cowboys and the Indians, and all of that kind of is developed within our psyche. And unfortunately, with the tremendous proliferation of guns, in our society today, that most folks now, unfortunately, as opposed to when I was a teenager, and probably even going back a generation or two from then, most teens and youth handled their situations with their fists. If there was a dispute, they settled it in a fist fight. And, sometimes you won, sometimes you lost, but hey, you lived to fight another day. And everyone went on. And eventually, sometimes you became good friends with that individual that, he was trying to knock his head off a month before. Now, it has changed to such a degree and to such a detriment now that, they're fighting with guns, and it's almost like our youth have lost their ability to resolve their conflicts peacefully or to even attempt to, So it's I don't have the magic answers, but I know we have to start in the most realistic ways, and that's within our own families, within our own neighborhoods, and try to grow from there.
What do you think we should do with guns in America?
Wow, well, we just made a big blunder, I would say, in allowing, or should I say, the fact that the assault weapons ban wasn't upheld. I think is a devastating blow that we're going to, unfortunately, probably see some pretty detrimental side effects that are going to come from that. Why should there be legalization of assault weapons? You don't need assault weapons to hunt. Military type agencies use these weapons, and now these weapons are so proliferate on the streets now. Mostly all of the drug dealers, this is their weapon of choice. And unfortunately, these guys can't shoot straight. So in the midst of all that, we have 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 3-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 7-year-olds, who are killed, some of them sitting in their beds, on their sofas at home, watching TV on their front porch, in their front yard, in the family car, So we have, these gun-toting cats, who are shooting indiscriminately. And unfortunately, sad thing and the sad reality behind that now is that we have many, many more of our victims from these random shootings becoming younger and younger.
Speaking of drugs, should we legalize drugs?
No, I don't think that would curb violence, and I definitely don't think it would be something that would bring forth any positive, outcomes for our community, our society today. I mean, we actually have, I think, the nation with the largest amount of drug users, you know. So, you know, legalizing it was probably only double, triple that amount, you know. And then what does that say to our youngsters? What type of message would that send? You know, when so much, you know, effort is being put forth in drug education to our youngsters. So you would ultimately have to throw all that out the window. So that definitely would not be the answer or the solution. I think prevention is more the way we need to look at it. As it's an old cliche that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. But truly, from our work and what we do in Pioneers for Peace, we know that if we're going to see anything, any of these things change in the future, it's going to be through the up and coming generations that are that are going to follow us. So we feel that our best hope and opportunity is to get these young minds now and have them carry the torch into this next millennium.
As I listen to you, I marvel at your inner peace and how positive you are. How do you get that?
Wow. Like I say, it's probably come from a number of years now. This one correction, I've been in a wheelchair 19 years now, and I'm 35 years of age. And over these last 19 years, my life has it's been quite an interesting journey, quite a wonderful journey, though, I feel, because all of the various experiences, the various adversities, the trials, the tribulations, and even many of the triumphs have all helped to cultivate my spirit and my being. And this experience has allowed me to grow, you know, tremendously as a human being. And I think all of that together has helped shape my perspective on life now, and feeling that, you know, like I said, I'm truly blessed to be doing what I'm doing. I'm also feeling that I'm doing God's work, and that everything that happened in my life has truly been in divine order. And I'm riding the wave, you could say.
Could you share with our young listeners in 1 minute, what would your basic message be to them?
First off, be yourself. One of the things that we see all too often, and it's disturbing, that some of the youngsters are in such identity crisis right now. And you have so many negative self-images and negative stereotypes that youngsters are trying to feel in order to try to fit in. And we ultimately, I try to encourage them to be yourself. You don't have to do anything extra or be a certain way to impress anyone, you know, and to be, you know, honest, you know, with yourself, and ultimately, you know, set goals for yourself and do what you have to do to work towards that goal, and don't let other people, be it family or friends, turn you away from your goal.
What are your dreams and hopes?
Wow. Well, my dream and hope is to one day live in a nation. I'll even take a city, actually, where we don't have children die through senseless violence, you know, and to one day see us be able to live in a society where we don't need guns. And I know that's probably wishful thinking, but ultimately, the gun at one time was not invented, you know, and you have to look at life existed, you know, and things went on wonderfully. And, you know, now I see us moving more and more towards the technology, developing more and more and greater and bigger and stronger ways to destroy things. And I think we centered ourselves back to a more holistic, more being more balanced with nature, you know, I think our society and our world will be a much better place.
Wayusi, you're amazing. Dr. Tom Dooley had a very short life. One quote from him: I am only one, but I am one. I cannot do everything, but I can do something. What I can do, I ought to do, and what I ought to do, by the grace of God, I will do. You live that.
Thank you.
Thanks for your amazing story and coming. Our guest next Sunday will be the supernatural, the Hall of Fame cornerback for the Detroit Lions, Lem Barney. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because anything is possible. Spahn.